Welcome to the Cult of Personality membership section. Thank you for supporting the show.
I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. And in this Cult of Personality membership section recording entitled Altar of Burnt Offering, mystic, artist, and author David Chaim Smith and I explore a myriad of topics that are very pertinent to spiritual seekers. And David and I agree that this is perhaps the most important and the most interesting conversation that we've ever recorded. Try to analyze, if we can, some concepts that people often promote. And these things, I think, we've talked in the past about how they don't really lead where people may think they do, that they either lead nowhere or to a place where they're not only going to not make progress, but they'll actually be doing themselves harm. I think the easiest one to start with is really drugs. And drugs is probably not the right even word to describe what I'm trying to talk about. More psychedelics, entheogens, the whole neo-shamanistic movement that celebrates the use of things like ayahuasca and ecstasy and LSD and mushrooms, peyote, things of that nature to try to expand consciousness and to use these things as a way to do so. And I think we've seen this from like Timothy Leary and in more modern context from someone like Terence McKenna.
Okay. I'd like to tell a story about the one and only interaction I had with Terence McKenna, which is a pretty funny story, and it sets the tone for exactly what you're talking about. I think it was in the early 90s, it was 91, 92, something like that, at the New York Open Center, where I was a presenter on the same night that Terence McKenna was presenting something. And I had my usual five people, and he had his usual 150 or whatever it was. So I figured something was going on, so I went down there to listen to him, and what I heard was exactly what you're talking about. A series of statements that promoted the use of psychedelics as a way to induce mystical experience, genuine mystical experience. Now, from my own standpoint and from my own use of these drugs, which was extensive and profound, I came to a series of other conclusions about the nature of these substances and what they do to people. I am of the opinion that psychedelics, entheogens, whatever you want to call them, do not increase spiritual sensitivity. They diminish spiritual sensitivity. They give you the impressions of mystical experience while you're under the influence of the drug, meaning that you expand your capacity to create ideations, to create mental impressions that seem to reflect or mimic mystical states while you're under the influence of the drug. Now, I have various opinions about the efficacy and authenticity of these ideations. I don't believe that they're in any way related to mystical experiences, but I think that they are sufficiently different from normal cognitive patterns that they open up a door into a realm of possibilities that seems substantially different and a huge departure for most people. So automatically, there's this opportunity to explore something else, which is good in a way. However, When the drug wears off, the person goes back to the status quo. That is a given. Mystical experience that one disciplines oneself for and practices hard at and works day after day after day, wallowing through quite a bit of boredom most of the time, creates permanent systemic change. Now, the idea of working hard to create permanent systemic change versus a very elusive facsimile of mystical experience that goes away when the drug wears off, leaving you exactly like you were before, I don't see any comparison there. As far as I'm concerned, compounded with the damage that the drug itself might or might not do, and I'm not a medical expert, so I can't specify technically exactly what form this damage arises in, but let's just say for the point of argument that it's not creating a greater state of neural health as a baseline. Let's say that this is a risk. Let's leave it as an open question. Given that compounded in with the idea that it wears off, I don't see how anyone can make the comparison to a true spiritual practice, an authentic spiritual practice that changes you permanently and for good. Obviously, anything in this universe that has any value, one must work hard at and struggle for. The idea of taking a drug to be the passive recipient of something spiritual, whatever that might be, as far as I'm concerned, just plays to the lowest common denominator of the consumer mentality. It's the quintessential mistake of our culture. The idea that you have paid to be the recipient of some edifying experience that will somehow elevate you, the idea that it's just that easy, is quite disgusting, actually, if you think about the types of distortions that arise from this type of thinking in other areas of life. So being as though that is a related concern, it seems to me to have the aroma, the smell of something wrong. And I think New Agers, who in a quick and unexamined manner jump too rapidly to the conclusions that these experiences are truly mystical, that you are participating in a tradition, that you are working a path, without harsh condemnations being given to these ways of working, I think that we could start out by saying that the people who are making the mistakes with these systems are not examining them enough, and as a result are creating a very superficial understanding of what spirituality is and what mysticism is. And yes, although it's different and possibly leading to an improvement of ordinary conventional cognitive states, it is in the long term that we see the real problem. In the short term, we can debate back and forth on the nature of incidental experiences. But here's the point I'm trying to make. In mystical practice, the acquisition of experiences is not even very important. Experiences come and go. Phenomena comes and goes. It's not about acquiring new and unusual types of experience. Mental experience is the byproduct of one's cognitive patterns and one's cognitive condition. The idea is not to acquire more of these relics of your experiential life. The goal is to change the nature of the cognition that produces those experiences in the first place. The experiences are just an indicator of how the cognitive process is working. So the idea that one is so focused on experience without proper focus on the nature of the cognition that provides that experience seems short-sighted and to miss the point entirely. So as a result, you have a mistake being made, that the mistake is mysticism is about strange and new disembodied fluid experiences. Although those are nice and they're an indication of something, if we chase after them, we will find ourselves ultimately no different than we were before, because essentially we are the same passive spectator that we are in conventional life, except now we're watching walls melt rather than watching television, let's say. I don't think the mentality is really very different. I think the type of passivity that you see in most psychonauts on entheogens, although the experiences are wildly different than conventional ones, I think the mentality is largely the same. It's passive, it's consumer-oriented, and it glorifies surface and superficial changes rather than fundamental endemic ones.
Well, this is really interesting, I think, and I appreciate you sharing your opinions, especially because they're based, as you said, on years of experience with the very substances that we're talking about. So you're not someone who is an outsider pointing the finger. You've actually done this yourself probably countless times and have formed rather solid opinions and understandings based on your experiences, which I think is important because as many of the advocates of this type of philosophy, you don't have many people appreciating this type of thing who haven't experienced it. I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's no substitute for experience in anything in life. Having the experience itself may not be the most important thing, but it is important to some extent. I want to share my own experience in this realm with you because I don't necessarily disagree with what you've said, but I want to make the argument that it's not the substances themselves that are the issue, in my opinion. It's really the people using them and their intention and mindset when they do it. I agree with you. I don't think these things are in any substitute for any kind of a practice. But personally, I had an experience myself with a substance. Granted, I researched the more traditional shamanistic ways of using it and did it in that manner as best I understood. But the experience was profound, and what it did was really just lead me to where I am now with the knowledge that using that substance was not the way to get where I'm going. It was simply an avenue to present me with the answer to the question that I was seeking. And from there, it was just a lot of hard work and, as you said, boredom and arduousness to get anything accomplished. But with that said, if it hadn't happened, I don't know that I would be talking with you right now.
Well, I think it's a great thing when any experience leads someone to do spiritual practice. If drugs, or people sometimes even object to the term drugs, if psychoactive substances lead someone to a life of authentic spiritual practice, then they're a winner. They won the lottery. You know, then they did the most rare and precious thing that a human being can do, and if that was what got them there, then it succeeded in its intention to improve and expand the vistas of their life. That's fine. I have no problem with that whatsoever. It's the idea that the drug becomes the practice where the trouble rests.
Right.
I think if the drug leads you to practice, fine. If the drug even leads you to a deeper consideration, fine. Even if it becomes just sort of philosophical speculation, that's generally an improvement over the conventional state as well. But it's the idea that comes from this line of thinking that comes down from Timothy Leary through Terence McKenna up to the people of today. I know Eric Davis is one of them. The idea that the use of psychedelics ritually becomes the sacrament, becomes the practice itself, I think that is dangerous and should be condemned. People might dispute this with me, but as far as my own viewpoint is concerned, the goal of mystical practice is to nullify the separation between a perceiving subject and perceptual objects. So if the perceiving subject becomes an object themselves, I am me, I am an autonomous, separate and independent being, I make an object of my own identity, then of course everything that comes into my mind becomes separate from that because I've made myself autonomous and separate. Therefore, my thought about myself becomes a perceptual object. My thought about what comes through my senses becomes a parade of perceptual objects. Certainly objects in my so-called external world, my emotions, my ideas, my speculations become a series of independent objects that are all separate and fragmented and different from each other. So the world becomes fragmented, right? If we say that that characterizes the conventional state, characterizes the problem, don't you think that the acquisition of experiences and chasing after experiences becomes just a glorified way of doing exactly that? You're chasing after new and better objects, new and better perceptual thought objects to reify, separate from each other, and put into your shrine of specialness. Now you have this special state that you've achieved, and you, the independent being, now have had this experience. And it doesn't seem to attack the basic fundamental problem most of the time. Now, of course, what happens to people in psychedelics is they have these disembodied, more fluid types of versions of this, where their identity seems to go past the body outline and flow into the space around them, flow into appearances, meanings that seem, that reify and identify things seem to be exchanged and expanded and flux and flow. And that's the open door. That's fine. But that's not the point. The point is to draw a set of conclusions from that about the nature of identity and its essentiality. Unless somebody has the ability to take that extra step, turning the ontological ocean on itself is not going to do you any good. Because you could have that experience and snap back and, like I said, go back to exactly the way you were before. It takes the ability to recognize something essential there and stabilize in it, stabilize abiding in it, such that that abiding can lead you to a reassessment of the process of identification and identity itself, and thereby, through repeated practice, change the underlying fundamental habits that keep snapping you back to the status quo every time you push the boundary. So if you think about it, just acquiring these expanded states doesn't do that, because that requires discipline. That requires going against the grain. That certainly requires the discomfort of having to correct yourself over and over and over. So if you just passively create this rarefied yourself, what you're going to end up with is sort of a monstrous, hyper-exaggerated version of your convention. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah. I got another call coming in, so I hope you got all of that.
I think so, yeah.
But what I'm saying is essentially psychedelics tend to turn the conventional state into a Frankenstein's monster. And it does that by fabricating bit by bit this idea that you have somehow become better. You're just making that assumption. And collecting experiences is a way that at the same time one misses the basic point and the heart of the matter. One glorifies this alternative dimension and attributes all sorts of wisdom qualities to it that are really quite different from the wisdom qualities that are discussed in mystical texts.
Hmm. Well, and before we leave this subject, I just want to get your comment, because as far as I can gather, Terence McKenna, who we've been talking about throughout here, is probably the one of the main people responsible for the whole 2012 furor. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I didn't really get to my story before. But that night at the New York Open Center, I went to go check out Terrence McKenna, and I heard what he had to say, and it got me very angry. I ended up throwing something at him and getting kicked out of the New York Open Center, even though I was a presenter there. I threw a Twinkie, and I nailed him in the head really good. And I was forcibly ejected from the building and roughed up a little bit. He was a nice guy about it. He laughed, but his followers weren't laughing, I'll tell you that for sure. And the funny thing was that they seemed to forget about it, and I ended up presenting there probably five or six more times after that. But I did nail him in the head with a Twinkie pretty good, and he knew why. Because I got up and I said my piece, and everybody laughed at me, and I got so frustrated I just threw the closest available thing, which was a piece of pastry. And I'm not condoning that as a solution to the problem. It was a stupid juvenile thing for me to do. However, it was out of frustration because I grew up in the 60s and 70s believing this stuff. And I tried it out, as you said. I mean, I've taken LSD hundreds of times. I've done a lot of DMT, which is, of course, the chemical of choice for a great many people. It is, certainly is not a spirit molecule, as the book title professes. All molecules are spirit molecules. How can you say that one particular configuration, which is literally the replicate of major brain chemical involved in some profound activity, how can you say that that has isolated essentiality? That's ridiculous. It's a material substance that has an effect, and there's still such a thing as the free will and creativity that you could do with that effect a great many things. There was an organization called the Church of the Psychedelic in New York City in the 70s and 80s. They had a storefront on 9th Street, I think it was, and I used to go there all the time. And they offered what was called psychedelic communion with a series of substances, including one called DPT, which is similar to DMT. I did that quite a bit. I did quite a bit of this stuff. And what I found was that after all the experiences had come and gone, I still had the same fundamental cognitive patterns that I did going in, and nothing had changed whatsoever. So the mythology is that everything will be different. This is the solution to the drag or dilemma of your life. And it's just simply another fantasy projection of consumer culture, in my opinion. Now, shamanism is another story. I think if you live in a region where the elementals of the plant kingdom and the land itself can literally speak to you, there is a certain type of spirituality there that one can tap into. However, that is not going to hold true for a kid from New Jersey who takes a vacation to Brazil. They're not meant for that. They're a foreigner. And I think a lot of this is genetic and has to do with genetic lineage and DNA codes speaking to each other. Having said that, I still am unconvinced that these shamanistic practices are truly mystical traditions in the sense that I know mysticism to be mysticism. I would dispute that. However, I'm not going to say conclusively one way or another because I'm not in that and I don't have experience with those lineages. However, it seems a little sketchy to me, and to draw a broad generalization and say shamanism is equal to Western mysticism, I think is wrong.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Equalizing, yeah, I would agree. That's definitely not good.
But to ask your question about 2012 or the astrological alignment of the planets, or I mean, I don't even know what that is. It seems to me to be a bunch of New Age rhetoric. I don't know anything about it.
Well, I just find it interesting that the so-called bard of psychedelia, Terrence McKenna, happens to be the one who comes across with this very wild theory called Time Wave Zero about 2012 and the end of time. And now that we're in 2012 and all the furor that surrounds the year and all of this, I find it interesting that he's one of the people primarily responsible for this.
He was a very smart guy.
Yeah.
And his speculative thought took off in interesting directions, which probably created some interesting books. But in the end, I've never heard one really truly substantial teaching about an authentic, genuine, mystical system that one can engage to change one's habits to realize their nature. I have not seen that from him or anybody like him. What I've seen is a lot of interesting experimental, speculative, synthetic stuff drawing from various traditions and making speculative leaps. I don't see anybody there talking about a lineage. I don't see anybody there talking about actual work that one could do on oneself past just having these drug experiences and making certain assumptions. To me, it's sort of a glorified type of entertainment. It's sort of like the Robert Anton Wilson school of sci-fi spirituality, which entertains but ultimately goes nowhere.
This is interesting. Yeah, I was kind of holding back and even mentioning his name here. But I think that's a good way to kind of transition into some of the other areas that are maybe adjacent to these subjects, and that would might term things that some people consider practices or traditions. Even I that could be a stretch, but schools or philosophies that have come along that in your opinion just don't really go anywhere. And I'm not saying I necessarily think this, but you may think of maybe theosophy, the theosophy of the Theosophical Society, as something like this, or some people would say maybe chaos magic or whatever people lump into that bucket might be akin to this type of thing. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that there's a certain mentality that might come to the conclusion that any spiritual practice is better than no spiritual practice. And I'm not so sure that that's correct, because there is a potential for certain kinds of ideational distortion where one can become obsessed with certain fantasy-like beliefs that will lead one into a life of frustration and ultimately obsession with a series of axioms that don't bear fruit in allowing one to realize the expansiveness and beauty of their own nature. And I think that there's a lot of systems that spin their wheels in various ways, intellectually, practically, socially, sexually. And there's a tendency for these systems to lead just back into very refined, rarefied stratum of the human realm. And the human realm is just characterized by linear time and spatial location and the habit patterns that we're talking about moving past. Many of these systems just simply, like drugs, give you a rarefied take on what you already have and essentially don't change the fundamental habitual axioms that make you the way you are. And of course, there's a hierarchy here. Different systems do it to different degrees. Even systems through which one can realize some level of gnosis don't all add up with each other. And there's different shades of gnosis and different flavors of gnosis.
That's a really good point. And it brings me to a question that I think you're pretty well suited to address. And that's what I would term Jewish Gnosticism, for lack of a better term. And I'm going based on Gershom Scholem here. So excuse me if he's misinterpreted something or gotten something wrong, and I've thereby repeating his mistake. But it seems to me, based on his major trends in Jewish mysticism, that primarily the Kabbalistic schools didn't really have a view of the ultimate mystical experience that in my mind, agrees with the type of thing you're describing, where it's like total dissolution of perceptual time and space, dissolving of boundaries of the self, any awareness of one's own consciousness, maybe. I'm not really sure, having not experienced it myself. But it sounded like Shalom was saying in his book that the Kabbalistic schools didn't really view the mystical experience or the Gnostic experience in this way, that the individualization or individuation wasn't transcended, that there was always a barrier between oneself and the divine. Is that right, or am I misinterpreting?
Well, it's an interesting question, because there are systems that make that aspect of nullification the point of the system and the heart of the matter. And there are other types of systems in which true mystical nullification becomes sort of almost like a byproduct, something that happens as a result of the ecstatic absorption into one's devotional practice and the complexity of refinement through the esoteric disciplines themselves. And the Kabbalistic tradition is really all over the place with this. There are Kabbalistic lineages which certainly do not make it a point to dissolve the final boundary between the soul and the Godhead, if you will, as such. And there are other Kabbalistic lineages in which this happens spontaneously as a result of ecstatic mystical experience through even simple ordinary prayer. And this is always why I was so attracted to Hasidus, because Hasidus does view the mystical path ultimately as leading to the threshold of nullification, in which a certain aspect of the primordial paradox becomes apparent. You are not an individual, you are not independent, you are not real as an entity, but yet simultaneously there you are. So they're not saying that you are disappearing, that you're dissolving anywhere. They're saying that you're essentially nullifying identity and identification in a conventional way. You're getting rid of the conventions that hold you as separate and unique and detached from, in their system, ultimately God. And what you end up with is not so easy as to say you were one and now you are zero. What Hasidus essentially says is that one has to reconsider what the individual one and the divine zero imply, and that those meanings that we would normally or conventionally think of as being the answer to what is wholeness, what is a part within wholeness, that these are insufficient conceptual axioms that have to be worked through. And it's not in a series of conceptual answers that they're going to change. It's actually in practice, in the heart of practice, that they change, because what is being substituted for the conventional meanings is so subtle that language can't even point it out to anyone. So they're hinted at through living symbols and living symbol systems. In Hasidus, what you have is the intensity of absorption and the relationship of one's own process to their role in the worlds, in the Hishtalshelus, the chain of the worlds, that provides the opportunity for the disintegration of identity. That's very different than almost anything else. And to answer your question, Kabbalistic schools generally present an esoteric philosophy rather than a practical methodology. One can take the Kabbalistic esoteric philosophy and use it as the basis for practical mysticism, and that's what Hasidus did. However, you can't say that Kabbalistic philosophical schools have that as a goal, and that was probably what Sholem was pointing out, that there's a difference between speculative philosophy, even esoteric speculative philosophy, and living mysticism. The two overlap, they blend, they certainly connect at a certain point in certain cases, but they also can be quite different. And various Kabbalistic schools took these two elements, and you could see them getting closer and further from each other school by school, and you would have to take it on a case-by-case basis. This is why, like I said, Hasidus was so dear to me, because these really came together there, but also I think they did in the 13th century as well. And in particular, I would cite the school of Isaac the Blind as an example of this. But in the Lurianic schools, which I have a feeling that maybe what you read in Sholem was talking about the Lurianic schools, they tend to be extremely far apart at times. For example, the school of the Ramchal is an example of that, where one could say that Kabbalah becomes an esoteric form of logic that one uses for a rather conventional appreciation of Torah study. In that particular case, the goal is not nullification of identity, and certainly God created the universes as a separate creator deity, and there's a dualism implied, but within that there's a unity, and that paradox is held as a philosophical tenet rather than a living embodiment of the mystical path, and that's really quite different. So one has to take these things on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you very much for helping to clarify that, because it does seem to me that these concrete type of statements about what's true or what's not true in certain schools or lineages is never a good idea, all these generalizations. So appreciate that.
Well, there is you mentioned that final line between the absorption of the soul and Ein Sof as being something that's maintained in certain Kabbalistic schools. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who in a way is one of the most mystical of the Hasidic masters, has a great lesson about this, that he warns his followers, he encourages his followers to dissolve and absorb all the way, as much as possible. But then he says, when you get to that point that you really can cash it in, you hold back, and the flaming in your heart should not consume you. And you wonder, why would he say this? Why would he say that flame in your heart shouldn't consume you, when you think that that's sort of the point of the whole thing, is to be consumed? Well, what he's talking about is very elusive. What he's saying is that achieving an experience of nothingness is not the point, because our idea of what that is or what that can be is completely erroneous. Ultimately, you're never going to disappear. No matter how far you go on the mystical path, there you are. And the goal is to realize a fundamental paradox, not to escape, not to disappear from the worlds, not to go elsewhere. There is no elsewhere, right? So the whole point is to realize a fundamental paradox where something and nothing are not useful terms anymore, that you can get past the schism between being and non-being, and such considerations like the schism between real and unreal, or conscious and unconscious, that for a mystic, these are entirely unuseful terms and fundamentally are relics of the conventional state.
Now, it's interesting, because in thinking about things in these ways, it becomes really clear to me how the mystic is very often the heretic, or almost always the heretic, because what you're talking about essentially is, you know, there is no Metatron. You have to be Metatron, if I'm understanding you correctly.
But then the question is, what is the you?
Well, I guess you have to tackle that once you get to that point.
Well, you see, this is the area where Kabbalah, for example, as the esoteric philosophy, becomes incredibly useful. At the same time that you're endeavoring to engage these mystical methodologies, the idea of having some sort of cohesive view to fall back on, to get one's bearings, to be able to support one's practice, incredibly important. Otherwise, you'd be lost. So, for example, if you have a conventional fixation that identifies self and other, then every entity, with or without a body, is going to be a separate intelligence to you, like Metatron, right? The idea that there is a Metatron is just as ridiculous as the idea that there is a you. No more, no less. So if you reify yourself, of course you're going to reify Metatron. If you don't reify yourself, you're not going to reify Metatron either. Then that becomes an opportunity to engage meaning on a whole new level. And then the issue of Metatron becomes something entirely different.
Yeah, this is again, I think, kind of goes to the core of a lot of what you talk about. And that's one of the reasons I appreciate speaking with you so much, is because your perspective is, whether good or bad, is so radical and mystical and so different than the conventional point of view that it's really a breath of fresh air.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because there's a danger with that too, and that's the idea that I, or anyone else for that matter, because they act on certain views and have practiced to whatever degree to realize whatever degree of those views, that inculcates a certain specialness, that you're somehow special now and different from everybody else, and the people who are stuck in the conventional state are, you know, considerably lesser than you in your elevated state, which that right there is the easiest way to destroy whatever potential practice you could possibly make. There is no specialness in any of this. The whole idea that you are stepping away from the human race, which is a valuable impulse, but the idea that stepping away from the human race thereby elevates you as some sort of super being or special being, worthy of special magical consideration, entirely unuseful. And that's the easiest way to take everything that I'm talking about and turn it into a real catastrophe. Because if somebody had a little success in their practice and thereby lorded it over the rest of creation, my God, what a monster you would have unleashed on the world at that point. The best way to judge a system is you check out the followers and you see how the system has affected them. And if there are many of them, you can make certain generalizations based on patterns that you see happening over and over again, place to place, time to time. And you ask yourself the question, are certain tendencies or trends endemic to the system? And I think that generalizations are harmful, but very often they can also be true. I think that there are very few great realizers in the West that are comparable to a figure like, let's say, Saraha or Padmasambhava or any of the Mahasiddhas. There are very few. There are certainly some, and they can be acknowledged through the lineages, systems, writings, and practices that they brought into the human realm. And I think that's the basis through which we have to look at them and assess their gifts to us. But then, ultimately, after we've made that assessment, we bear the burden of practice ourselves. And we got to ask ourselves whether this is just merely an interest of ours amongst many conventional interests, or whether it's something else, whether it's an opportunity for us to truly grow out of a series of habits that are endemic to the nature of our own cognitive state.
Now,
Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think it's important. I want to make sure we cover this before we run out of time. Okay, we understand the goal in a general sense, the nullification of the self or communion with the Godhead, however you want to term it. What then? Because, I mean, God willing, you know, even one person listening achieves this. What then? I mean, are they just going to know what to do and we don't have to worry about it? Or... Is there some further you know, explication that that is really, well, it's certainly desired by all of us who are still behind, but you know, but at that point, what then?
Well, what we're talking about here is the idea that we're sick and tired of petty relative meaning as the end-all and be-all of our mind's life, and we are interested not in accumulating more greater and better and shinier relative meanings, but some absolute opportunity for meaningfulness itself. And the idea that meaning can shift qualitatively rather than quantitatively is really the question that you are asking. You're asking if the opportunity for meaning that essentiality can provide in our lives, what is that? What then? Well, ultimately, truth, goodness, and beauty are the natural consequence of that aspect of meaning. That what we're talking about here is the idea of operating from a standpoint of something that people are not comfortable with, which is faith, right? I'm not talking about dogmatic faith or religious faith. Certainly not. What I'm talking about is faith that beauty is in itself sublime. And the medium is the message, as Marshall McLuhan says. Meaning, the meaningfulness that I'm talking about is beauty, is truth, is absolute goodness. Now, I'm not talking about actualizing a god or a set of codes set up by some human being somewhere. What I'm talking about is the idea that intuitively, a spiritual seeker will feel that there is something more than this, this being the conventional small meanings that constitute our mind's conclusions about our life and life itself. The idea that fundamental, endemic, right in the heart of the matter, right in the midst of all of that speculating and perceiving, is a vastness which radiates beauty, essentially radiates knowingness beyond knower and the known, or knowing anything particular. Certainly not in the sense that you could accumulate more data or more experience, like we said before, but that in knowing, beyond experience and beyond the things that are known, there is ultimate beauty, ultimate luminosity, ultimate spaciousness, and ultimate meaning. And this is something that if you don't feel intuitively the thrust of this and the magnetic draw of this, then no language, no poetry is going to introduce this into your mind. There are beings which thirst for this endemically without knowing why. That's a seeker. Somebody who's trying to find solutions to philosophical problems might or might not understand what I'm trying to imply here. And then ultimately that becomes sealed as the witness dissolves in the act of that pursuit. That's the next step. You know, kill the witness. The idea that the witness is the boat that gets you across the river, and once you're on the other side, you don't need the boat anymore. You know, the klipa of Keter is Ehya Asher Ehya, I will be. Right, the I am is the klipa of Keter, because ultimately when Keter equalizes with En Sof, and 0 = 1 becomes the nature of the paradox of realization, I am becomes as useless as that boat that got you across the shore. But there you are. You don't disappear anywhere. You don't go away. You apprehend a level and depth of meaning that dwarfs the conventional concerns that were previous to that. But then you also realize that you haven't added anything that wasn't fundamentally there in the first place. That it was always that way. And the great realizers, you know, I think when I think of great realizers, I think of figures like Nisargadatta Maharaj, for example. I am that. How many works in the canon of Western mysticism deal squarely with the issue, successfully or unsuccessfully? You know, what you're talking about is a set of precepts that attempt to intersect the ineffable which by its nature goes beyond language. And it can spin off into so many different subdivisions and alleyways that take you on little circular trips around the main road. But getting on the main road and really dealing squarely with the issue and saying, okay, heading in a particular direction which realizes the absolute is all I'm concerned with. Everything else is a side note, a footnote. How many works of mysticism in the canon of Western literature actually do this? Not many.
No.
I mean, there are certainly some. You mentioned Kabbalistic lineages before. How many do it within the Kabbalistic literature?
Mm.
Not many.
Not many. No, I find more in the alchemical tradition, but they're always so veiled that if you don't understand it, you're not going to know what he's talking about anyway. But with Nisargadatta, I mean, his big point, aside from his general, you know, questioning, who am I, was this idea that the only quality that was required in order for someone to attain was earnestness. What's your thought about that?
By earnestness, you can draw a series of conclusions as to what he was talking about, but one of them he spoke about in terms of himself and his own realization. He said in a very simple way that his teacher gave him certain basic precepts and he believed them. And that was that. You know, and one of those precepts were, your identity is that which you were before you were born. In other words, that which you are by virtue of the fact that you have conventional habits to lead you to a series of points of identification, that's not you. And if that's not you, then all the things that seem to exist relative to this fictional you, they're questionable as well. And that includes everything. So he said when his guru told him that, he just simply believed him and he pursued as such until he realized the pneumius or the inner depth of this teaching. And it was a very simple matter. It wasn't a big esoteric convoluted labyrinth. It was a very simple set of pith instructions, which he just accepted earnestly and pursued until their end. And that end was the dissolution of the I am in the, I don't want to use the term nothingness, but he does, and his heirs do. They use the term nothingness, but I think that's a problematic term for a Westerner because it posits a duality with somethingness.
Yeah, right. No doubt.
However, when you read that literature, certain words have to be exchanged. For example, when he talks about consciousness, he's not talking about pure awareness. When you use terms like that, you got to ask yourself, does consciousness represent the conventional state or does pure awareness represent the conventional state? Does one represent the mystical realization or not? So, you know, like in my book, I use the term pure cognizance as opposed to consciousness. When I use the term consciousness, I'm talking about mind in conventional perception. When I use the term pure cognizance, I'm talking about mind in gnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, you know, and there's no gold standard for language. You got to look at every system and every writer using the words the way that they do as idiosyncratic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's
a good point. You got to get somebody's language straight before you can follow their points. And that has proven to be a huge problem with Nisargadatta.
Yeah.
Because he makes statements about consciousness, and then people think he's talking about actually the opposite of what he's talking about.
Right. I can get that because the book is written in dialogue form. You can actually see or read the frustration of the questioner as they miss his point over and over and over again.
Yeah. And he's also not in any hurry to correct that.
No, it's clear how he draws out these sort of side journeys down labyrinthine little areas of thought to sort of bring these people out into more to where he's coming from. And sometimes they get there, and most of the time it seems like they don't. But just say that if people have not read that book, they should. I found personally that that was like you said, it was one of the most clearly distilled examples of true mystical realization that I've ever encountered. And it's astounding, I think.
Well, I'll say something else that no one ever talks about, which is the fact that that same level of discussion and type of discussion exists in the Hasidic literature. And nobody ever talks about that. And I'll tell you, occultists would love it. If your average occultist concerned with these matters got a copy of Rebbe Nachman's Likutei Moharan or some of the works of the Maggid of Mezrich, they would go crazy. They would absolutely love it. Most people, when they think of Hasidus, they end up finding literature from the Chabad tradition, which is fine, but it's really quite different.
Now, let me ask you, because I think this is an important thing you bring up. Do you have any thoughts about why it is that although these texts would clearly be of interest, great interest to people who were pursuing esoteric practice and learning about Kabbalah in general, but unlike, say, the Golden Dawn or Thelema or even Chabad or the Kabbalah Center, somebody can't just go to a meeting and join a Hasidic group. You know what I mean? There's a barrier there.
Well, each group you got to take on a case-by-case basis. Kabbalah Center is a total disaster. I think that that's
right. And I'm not encouraging people to check that out. I just want to say that right up front.
Yeah, I think that the groups which I have seen in my life and have been part of in my life that were most effective and most serious were the most exclusionary.
Exactly my point. And for someone who's not a Jew, you forget about it. I mean,
well, it's not only in Judaism. I mean, I've been part of other groups. I really prefer not to say what they were, but they're closed to the public, you know. And when a group is open to the public, you got to ask yourself why. Who are the public? The public generally are a bunch of people coming around who are not going to be very serious. So you'd think if you have some work to do, you'd want to keep out everybody but just the absolute necessary individuals for the work, so that you don't waste a lot of time. And it seems to me that if you're trying to grow your organization, you're already in the midst of some serious political troubles. And that's not a good sign.
Well, that brings up another really pertinent and relevant topic to this conversation, which is occult orders and groups and things. And I think your statements that you just made really go a long way towards informing us of your opinion of these more mainstream, I don't even want to call them esoteric groups. It's like this outer court, this type of thing. Now there are a lot of examples of this, but these groups that are recruiting people to join and be members, do you think these ever really lead to anything substantial, even if it's only to join an exclusive group down the road as an introduction? I mean, maybe that's all it's supposed to be. I don't know.
Well, there's different levels in which any group and their material can be useful. For example, you could become a Catholic and join the Catholic Church and get something useful out of that. What you're asking about is profound realization beyond just sort of spiritual assistance to increase the depth of your conventional state. How many of these groups really are set up to train people to do work that is radical in nature? Well, there are very few individuals who themselves have the aptitude for such things. So you're really not talking about a lot of people. And I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer, but as far as I'm concerned, almost every group is suspect. However, there are individual teachers and individual students who somehow, despite all that, seem to make it work. And they keep popping up, but there's not a lot of them. I am very suspicious about any group per se, but I am incredibly suspicious about groups that seem to function like corporations. And you got to ask yourself, when you're looking at one of these groups, to what extent does this organization seem like a corporation? For example, Catholic Church, it is a corporation. I mean, it's nakedly so. But I think it is a very good idea to look at material as timely for the time being. Meaning, is it what you need at this moment? Is it useful for you at whatever stage you seem to be at? The same thing with the teacher. You don't look for the ultimate best guy that could possibly be. He wouldn't even, if you found such an individual, they wouldn't even be useful to you. What you need to find is a teacher who is just ahead enough of where you are that they're going to be able to talk to you in a way that will connect and make a legitimate and authentic connection through which growth can occur. You're not looking for spiritual status here. You're looking for function, you know, to ultimately create this qualitative change that I mentioned earlier.
Mm.
And this is why the whole idea of teachers becomes suspect, because what are the credentials for the role of someone like that in your life? Is it to impress you, to impress others, to bully you, to bestow upon you a fiction or a fantasy? Or is it just good, earnest, authentic, genuine work that needs to be done with the constituents and elements at hand? And ultimately, you got to take these things in a very simple way at face value. What is the nature of the problem as it lives in you right now, and what are you going to do about it? You could make any grandiose statement that you want about the philosophical precepts, but the real question always remains, what are you going to do about it? You know, what are you doing and why?
Yeah, and I would encourage people to question, because I will readily admit I've been duped, I've been fooled, I've been screwed over more than once by so-called teachers or occult orders or groups. I don't think that's unusual.
Well, here's a good question for you then. If a so-called charlatan gives you something that you can actually use at the exact time that you can use it, are they really a charlatan?
It's semantics at that point. But I find even if they give you something useful, I'm not saying these people were, you know, came into my life and totally destroyed things and they served no purpose whatsoever. Quite the opposite. In fact, I think I learned a lot more than I might have from someone who was legitimately trying to help teach me, because maybe I just learned better by, you know, the hard method. I don't know. I certainly got a lot out of it, but it wasn't fun.
Well, and then you kind of won the lottery then, because, you know, let's say that you develop a connection with a character like this and you really grow, you really create a connection that gives you something useful. And as a result of that, you do some serious work. And then that character turns out to be an untrustworthy person in ways that really might or might not have anything to do with you. And you determine that they are indeed a charlatan to one extent or another because of their actions down the road. Does that discount the initial breakthroughs that they were instrumental in facilitating in you?
No, I don't think it discounts them at all. I think they're still legitimate. I would still consider the person a teacher, but at the same time, I would never ever recommend them to anyone else.
Oh, well, that's a different issue. We're talking about a highly personal thing here.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm grateful for what I learned. I'm bitter about the way I had to learn it.
And the bitterness, I think, is not going to serve anyone well.
I don't think so either.
there's a great deal of, I keep mentioning the Hasidic literature, but it's a really good example of this. There, I'd rather not cite it, but there are certain precepts in Hasidus that I have read that talk about what happens when you are optimistic and dwell on the good points of your spiritual work. And without getting into a whole big thing about that, one thing that they're trying to establish is a view of the nature of the process that is somehow removed from all the worldly conventional bullshit.
Right.
There is this idea that one should take spiritual work as an endeavor which is itself and really should be removed from all the worldly political struggle and power games and all of that stuff which characterizes conventional thinking. However, if in the middle of your spiritual work this worldly crap comes in and usurps the context, which happens almost always, what do you do about it then? Well, the idea that you should dwell on the work itself to the exclusion of ruining that work or poisoning that work with considerations of the inevitable human realm infection that you know is going to come in. It's going to come in any organization with any teacher. It's just going to. So the question is, do you happily tip your hat and move on and dwell on the good work that was done, or do you get all bent out of shape over something which really is from the outside of that, that has the ability to corrupt and usurp that and thereby undermine what could have been real progress? Well, this Hasidic teaching that I'm thinking about suggests that judging the merits of transformative work on the good point rather than the bad point is efficacious.
That makes a lot of sense. I completely agree with it. And I would also say that I think it's possible to acknowledge the good and focus on the good while still remembering, not dwelling, not hopefully not being bitter like I am, but just remembering, because those lessons that I learned or people learn along the way, they have to be retained, right, in order to be useful.
You know, what gets called into my mind with what you're mentioning is, in a particular community where I lived, I had a teacher who I was very close with, and there was another realized individual in this community who was not officially my teacher, but yet I learned from them a lot. And this particular individual that I'm thinking of was not certainly a bad person, but they weren't a nice person either. You know, and you got to ask yourself, when you see a highly realized person who's maybe not so nice, or maybe a little scary in various ways, you got to ask yourself, well, what does this mean? Does this mean that I should also strive to be not so nice? What does the not niceness actually do in my life? And what do I do with it? And that's a pretty profound question. There really are no clear-cut answers. But what I found with this particular person was, if I look at what can be accomplished with them, it's off the map. But if I waste my time thinking about conceptualizing about them in a conventional way, about how they're not very nice and they're this and they're that and they did this and they did that, I'm going to waste my time on a bunch of worldly crap where I could really be learning from this person. So in that particular context, best to blow it off. And what I found with this person is, as soon as I started to do that, my view of them changed. And all of a sudden, their not niceness was not a problem for me at all. However, it remained a huge problem for other people, which became kind of humorous to me. And I'd rather not get into any more specifics about that.
No, that's okay.
A lot of the lineages which seem to have died out that we never, ever hear about are not from Hellenized Egypt, which you're talking about lineages that essentially are sort of Alexandrian in nature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The lineages which no one ever talks about are the Hellenized Persian lineages, which seem to retain teachings of non-duality and mystical teachings about the nature of identity in a very different way. And that got kind of lost in the shuffle. particularly in the 19th century, when this sort of hermetic school of Kabbalah got popularized and sort of dumbed down and became the standard currency of Western esoterica, almost as if Hellenized Persia, which went all the way into India and, you know, was really ultimately what the theosophists were talking about but didn't understand or have a connection with, or they couldn't even get the text right. They kept veering back into the Vedas and whatnot, which was totally irrelevant. But Hellenized Persia, and you can see evidence of this in artworks from the period where you see styles blending, showing you Greek and Indian aesthetics combining. We have lineages that still survive to this day, but they're extremely closed mouth to ear, and generally tend to be closed and do not want you come sniffing around, which goes back to what we were talking about a second ago.
Right.
You know, There are Western schools of Tantra that would make the Golden Dawn offshoots blush if they had any idea what was right under their nose.
Knowing that they're out there and actually encountering them or their work is so different. I mean,
well, it is possible. It is possible in various ways through meeting various individuals. As you know, I don't really talk about my personal work and my practice or things in a personal way or make claims for myself like that. I hope that I never do that. So I really don't want to say anything about that, but it's a sticky situation. I don't even tell my wife what it is that I do. I think one of the things that I also need to clarify is the idea that I think one of the greatest corruptions in Western esoterica is this idea of making your practice, which is an intensely personal and private affair, making that sort of a fashion statement. What happens as a result of this is that spirituality can degenerate into a form of exhibitionism, which is entirely superficial, entirely corrupt, and entirely mundane and worldly and conventional and devoid of any of its profound characteristics. So when this happens, when you get groups of individuals exhibitionistically putting on stage shows of what would otherwise be an intensely personal extended process, you really got to wonder about first principles. Why are you doing what you're doing in the first place? Is it to impress me? However, having said that, I think that creating works of art and using creativity to express the fruits of one's practice is an entirely different story. So on one hand, you have creative work. On the other hand, you have exhibitionism. The dividing line between these two things very often can get hazy.
Oh, yeah.
It's an incredibly important question to ask yourself when you are a student or consumer of various views, seeking possibly answers for your own situation. You get people like that listening to our conversation that we're having right now. You know,
right.
To what extent could you criticize a particular point of view for being merely exhibitionistic? And what does that mean? What does it mean that somebody presents their spirituality like a fashion statement?
Well, let me pose this to you, because I think it's possible for something to be both totally superficial in one sense in an exhibition, and yet on the other hand still transmit something of the sublime. And to me, the example of that is Freemasonry, because you can have everybody in the room except for the candidate be oblivious to the highest or higher significance of the ritual, the words they're speaking, what they're doing, and yet they can still transmit something of that timeless, eternal quality through their actions and words. And they may not even fully have the intention to do that. Their intention may simply be to not screw up their lines. You know what I mean?
I think what you're talking about now is just endemic into the nature of symbols. Symbols have no fixed meaning. They are multidimensional in the implied meanings. If something has a fixed meaning, it's just a conventional signifier. So Freemasonry, which is a symbol system that one lives out through ritual and participation with a group, what you have is a series of doorways that one can pass through should one be able to open them. And all symbols are like that. All appearances are like that. This is not even a question of something that's endemic to esoteric teachings. Ordinary objects are symbols in this way, are living symbols in this way. What an ordinary object presents as its meaning is an open-ended question that is limitless. And of course, you could view it as superficial, and there you go, that's what you get. Or one could pass through that and permeate level upon level upon level of subtle meaning until ultimately an ordinary object becomes a wisdom teaching in and of itself. An ordinary thought, an ordinary emotion, a rock in the street, a piece of dog shit, all of these things have that transformative capacity. The world and its appearances is magic, is the presentation of the magical continuum. And the nature of that is a labyrinth of multidimensional connections. Should one have the view to see it that way and the ability to bear that view through in one's pursuits. And this is like getting back to the beginning of our conversation. This is where the drug mentality makes a tremendous error, because psychedelics lead you to the conclusion that there is this type of an inner life. And in that sense, that conclusion would be correct. However, what are you going to do with that opportunity? Are you just going to passively digest it as yet another thought object, except a more rarefied one? Or are you going to pursue something greater now that that door has been opened? You know, people really don't generally honor these impulses. They have these intuitions of spirituality and possible growth, and it leads them to various changes in their life. But to see that all the way through into a living, disciplined, authentic daily practice is incredibly rare. Even so-called spiritual practitioners very often don't have strong daily practices. You know, you're really talking about a minority of people here who are going to be able to follow up on any of this stuff. Which I think, you know, you don't want to beat people over the head with what they're not doing, but neither do you want to titillate them into reaching for something that they'll never get.
Well, that's a good point.
You know, so it's tough to talk about these things. One thing that happened to me when I stopped teaching is I decided I'm just going to write and draw, create works of art that are based on my point of view, if you want to call it that, and not explain it. Just leave it at that. People will do with it whatever they're going to do with it. The more I can reflect, obviously, the better it will be. However, I'm not trying to sell anyone on anything or promote anything. I'm not, or otherwise you're making propaganda, which is, of course, not a virtue in the sense that we're talking about these things. You know, we're not out to propagandize, to swing people over to our way of thinking.
Right. That reminds me of Krishnamurti, you know, when he would begin his lecture, you know, this is not propaganda. We're not trying to convince you of any point of view.
Yes, but you also have to remember that when he was on a plane, he'd take off his shoes and put shoe trees in them for the 20 minutes he was on the flight.
Well, see, this is what we need to make these people who seem almost beyond human, just to bring them back a little bit and make them seem just like the rest of us. Like, Krishnamurti, great spiritual realizer to some extent, whatever greater or lesser, still he's anal about his shoes.
That's
about stuff too.
This kind of goes back to what I was saying when I brought up that Hasidic teaching about concentrating on the good point in one's practice. That, yeah, if you take the worldly context of a being teaching you something and you say, okay, within this is something that I've got to isolate and see it out of context and treat it as so precious in my life and so private that I'm not even going to talk about it with anybody. This is the reason for secrecy in one's work. Why take the bread out of the oven before it's cooked? You know, leave it in there. You know, take the worldly matters that will prematurely externalize the internal and just discount them. Keep it as a private, the most private of all possible areas of your life. And in that way, it will be free to grow without the scrutiny of the pressure of having to show it off or debate or discuss with anyone else's point of view other than your own hard-won viewpoint that cannot even be communicated in language. I mean, ultimately, the things that lead us to do what we do, should we be able to do something genuine and authentic, are beyond language, beyond the conventional signifiers of language. They're symbols. They're living symbols.
Right.
Living symbols need to be guarded and protected and kept away from the marketplace.
What is your first duty? To guard the temple.
Right, exactly. And that's why secrecy works. It just simply works. And I'll tell you something else. Another area which very rarely gets discussed, the idea that in practice, the conscious streams of discourse and unconsciousness suffuse each other and begin to blend together. If you go blabbing about this in conventional superficial language, in superficial conventional context, that alchemy will not gel. Mm-hmm. It will not happen. Right? Unconsciousness is by its nature silent and dark. When the revealed waking world joins it on its own terms and a third thing is formed as a result of their union, this has to be secret by its nature.
Yeah.
And cannot be externalized. It is, by its nature, the ultimate internal. So secrecy works, and there's alchemical reasons why it must remain so. And this is why when it degenerates into exhibitionism, it just can't help but die. This is a huge problem.
It is a huge problem. And I'm not sure this is a great place to start to wrap it up, but probably should, in consideration of your time. And I want to thank you because the opinions and the experiences and the wisdom that you've shared with us here is really, really special. And I think that it's hard for me to appreciate it right now. And I know as I go back and edit this and listen to it again, and again, there's going to be little jewels here and there. And I think that's not just my experience, but I think, you know, a lot of people have echoed this when they've contacted me about listening to you talk about your work. So I thank you for that very much.
I thank you, Greg. I thank you very much. I had a great experience doing it. And, you know, it's always great to externalize private things with someone who really gives a damn. And I find that I get very surprised when I'm talking to you that I say things that I've never said out loud.
Wow. I'm really honored to be the person that is on the other end of the phone for that.
Well, there's a reason why I consciously stay away from doing that, and I kind of alluded to it, that it's bad for the process. But when you do it in a controlled way that really respects certain basic things, it's good to do it to a certain extent because certain boundaries are respected.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that was definitely the case here. So I come away thinking that I've magnified and clarified my thoughts on certain things.
Mm-hmm.